This is Ayan Ali, and I'm here with Janie Archie. Could you please say and spell your first name for me? Your full name for me.
Janie Archie, J-A-N-E-Y-A-R-C-H-E-Y.
Great. Today is November 5th. It's about 2 p.m., and we are in Janie's apartment in St. Louis, Missouri. Janie, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Great. Thank you, and thank you for participating. So could you just start off by telling me a little about where you come from and who you are?
Okay, I'm a 63-year-old white woman, and my family background is rooted in St. Louis. I was born and raised here, and I have 7 family members, or did, so a total of 8 of us, in working class area in University City, and then we moved to Melville when I was in 7th grade, and from there, you know, I was an adult after I graduated from high school, but from St. Louis.
Great. Could you tell me a little bit about your family?
Well, my family, large family. My father, very interesting, raised Catholic Irish background. My mom, Pentecostal, minister father. Very large family on her side. They lost one sibling, I think, but she had 9 brothers and sisters. And originally, I'm trying to think if she told me they came here from Kentucky, maybe. And my dad, he's the one who has a grandmother that was first generation here from Ireland. Anyway, so her family was not as large, but her husband, her second husband, was 25 years older than her, so we never met him. But anyway, so that's the two backgrounds. When they met and married at 17 and 18, they decided to become Methodist. And it infuriated my grandmother, who wanted them to raise us Catholic Irish. But anyway, that's what we ended up with. But that religion was never a big part of our family. I don't even know what it is to this day. And what's interesting about it is, I guess I'm more looking at this, became sort of aware of political stuff in high school when my best friend's brother introduced socialism to her and me in high school. And one of the other cheerleaders, I was a cheerleader, believe it or not, was kicked off the cheerleading squad for her and her twin brother, saying they were socialists. But anyway, Terry's brother was very, you know, just open about it. He was an anti-war activist, too, so that did sort of politicize me. But at 15, I wrote a letter to the Methodist church we belonged to and told them that I resigned. I wish I had a copy of it now still, because it's kind of interesting to think about. But anyway, so my family didn't say anything to me about it. They weren't real strict. They let us kind of pick our own friends and all that, except, and this is a big except, during the time of white flight in the late 60s in St. Louis, my family was a part of that. So we were told by my father that black people were moving into University City and that he needed to protect his girls. There were 4 girls and 2 boys. So we moved to Melville, which is basically still a predominantly white suburban area. You okay? Okay. And there I went to junior and senior high and graduated from Melville High School. So, I mean, when I was in University City, I loved it. It was very culturally, racially diverse, and most of my friends actually were Jewish. I was one of the couple of only Christian-raised families, and again, it wasn't really that. Except when I knew when there was high holidays and stuff like that, we'd be the only 3 sitting in the whole classroom. So it was kind of interesting. But they weren't the issue for my parents, Jewish folks. It was black people moving into University City. So we were part of white flight. I guess 1969 is when we moved to Melville.
Was that your kind of, with your friend's brother, was that your first kind of knowledge or memory of political groups and things like that? Was it your first entrance into politics?
I think so, and I didn't act on it. I just listened and was very interested in what people had to say, because one of the other things that happened before we moved that was a huge impact to me, and I didn't figure it out till much later, is my dad used to take us on Sunday rides. It's kind of a cheap thing to do when you have a big family, when gas was cheap back then, and we would go all over the place. And I remember my mom always being afraid, and my dad just going really fast. That was one of the reasons she was afraid. But we would go everywhere, all over St. Louis. And when we would get to a neighborhood, that he felt was a danger, he would tell us to lock the doors. So one time I looked over, locked my door, because that's what I was told to do, and there happened to be a black male in the car that saw me do it, a young person, and he locked his door. And I just will never forget that, because I thought, huh, so what does that mean? Because who is not safe here? You know what I mean? So, I mean, that has stuck with me all my life. But, yeah, so the high school thing, and then I didn't really start to act on it until I was in college, politically.
What was the effect, I think, of your father's racism and, like, being open with that and living in an all-white community? What was that like for you growing up?
Well, I mean, the first 13 years, it wasn't, well, that's true, it was all white, because as black folks moved in, we had to sell the house, the small house we had, so there was some racial equality in the schools for the first year. But then when I left at the end of the seventh grade and moved, it then went back to an all-white, because the Jews obviously in University City were of European descent. They weren't Jews of color. So anyway, when we got to Melville, yeah, it was like there were no Jewish folks. There were no people of color. And my father did get a raise, which was the other reason why, or a promotion, I should say, that we were able to move to a better house. So that also changed our kind of outlook. But it was sort of interesting because our house was mostly empty. It was just sort of a outside facade. None of the neighbors talked to each other hardly. Whereas when we were in University City, everybody was very close-knit. We walked to school. So this was the first time of riding a bus. But I think that carried with me into the fact that the school was all white. So for some reason then, that message just, I don't know what it meant until I actually then began talking to people, reading, and joining different groups and finding out what that was all about.
Did your family make comments about, like, members of the LGBT community in the same way that they made comments about people of color? Did they kind of, like, discourage you against that kind of, I don't know, behavior?
Yeah, when they knew what it was. Right. I mean, my dad died when I was, before I had my son. So, 22. I was 22. He was only 54. He died of a brain tumor at home. And at that time, I was in Springfield, Missouri for 2 years getting my early child education associates. And that, again, is an all-white city. And I think it still is pretty much. A lot of rural white area, but the city of Springfield is all-white, too. And so I went there. I came back and still almost all around all-white young people and myself. And I came back and wanted to finish my bachelor's. That's really what it was about. And went to Webster, and it was a little better. I would say there were probably more international students at Webster than there were locally people of color, African-American and Latino students at that time. So that was 82 to 84 I finished my degree. So, but while there, that's when I came out, had my first girlfriend that I met there in class, had a wonderful femtour teacher who later killed herself, but a feminist, a lesbian, just a literature was her main thing, and she kind of got me interested in reading stuff about multicultural education. So I think that's part of, I guess, my entrance too into, you know, what really do we want to teach kids? And I had taught at Head Start a couple years in Springfield before I moved back, and that was very low income and racially diverse children. The staff was all white, like many still are today, right? Clientele is people of color a lot of times in St. Louis City, and a lot of the people in charge are still white. But anyway, so that still was the case. But I was there 2 years to finish my bachelor's. And my first organizing there, coming out as a lesbian, I was also a single parent on AFDC, it was called then, welfare, and food stamps, was to try to open an on-site daycare center for parents. And they let us along, just like thinking that we were going to be able to do it. I have letters in there saying, thank you so much for your cooperation to the administration. And we rallied around. We had fundraisers. We had a plan. And they just completely blew us off at the end, and it never happened. But it was so needed. My son at the time was 4, I guess, and he went to a church daycare. Wasn't religious, but in the basement. And that's where I met one of my closest friends. She was a lesbian and one of his teachers at Webster Daycare Center. So that's still open. It's just a different location. It had a huge influence on him because he could be a kid of a lesbian family there. You know, he had some issues with some of the other teachers. But my family, getting back to your question, sorry, was not happy about it at all. Now, I do have a gay brother. He's younger than me, but he came out younger. And I don't know if that tide is changing since things are so much more open for people to come out. But at that time, he was 12, and it was not through a good relationship. And I didn't come out till 23. So he kind of paved the way for me, really. But my family was not, my dad and him have had fights, I mean, verbal, but he also chased him, and my brother ran away, and so I knew that. And then my dad got sick and passed away, and I didn't come out until 23. So my mom was very upset. She couldn't understand why I would say that when I had a child. I mean, at that time, this wasn't as heard of. Now about 30-40%, I think, of LGBT folks have children, closer to 40 probably. But at that time, either they were closeted and weren't having children, or I don't know. But so I was a part of a lot of things for lesbian parenting at Webster. We started a support group and tried to do the daycare. And we had a women's resource center, which we just insisted that lesbians were vocal, visible members of it. So that was really where a lot of stuff started.
Speaking of Webster, what was it like being a single mother in college? What was that like for you?
It was hard. The only main thing, and I just am so thankful to my mother, I had Justin at home with my mom. I mean, not literally, but I lived with her. Yeah, I wanted to. She was like, no way, you gotta go to the hospital. But I lived with my two brothers and my mom, and when I got pregnant. And I wanted to be pregnant. So I moved home from Springfield and lived with her. And, I mean, she was freaked out about it, but she was supportive. And she helped me. She loaned me the money for the Webster daycare. That's why I was trying to get the on-site sliding scale, right? Because mine could be down to zero on AFDC. So I ended up owing her $3,000 that I didn't get to pay her back until 2000. Long time. And then I paid her when I got some pension money, all of the pension money. But anyway, so she was not liking it. She thought it was bad on Justin. What would he think? And I said, well, I'm just going to try to raise him like it's as like everybody else's family. I mean, we are different, and I'm going to use language so he knows it is regular, you know, regular language. This is my partner, just like somebody says this is your husband. So it grew on her, I think, through the years. She would never go around talking about it, but she met several of my partners. Now, when I ended up with an African-American partner, that just added another layer for my family to deal with. And I was at one time banned from coming to anything for 4 years. And it wasn't because of the queer stuff. It was because I had a black partner. And my mom, quote, said to me, "What do I say to her?" And so we had a whole conversation of, hello, how are you? You know, how you get to know people. It's the same thing, Mom. And some of her racism, some of the stuff she said and did. But she fell in love with Terry, my partner I just split with of 17 years. And Terry loved her. And I think through that personal relationship, even after all those years, she had become the most supportive, my mother. My other siblings, they could take it or leave it, except my oldest sister now has a granddaughter that's come out. So that's, it's always interesting. You know, you never know. So anyway, so they've been okay. My dad never knew just because of my, you know, he's dead by then, but my brother and him went round and round about it. So, and that's why my brother and I are more connected than my other siblings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You spoke to me previously about kind of the obstacles that you face being a lesbian single mother and how you had a lot of issues with, I don't know if it was the state government or someone trying to take away your child. Could you speak on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, when you were on AFDC then, and this was, let's see, was it ADC, then AFDC, then it was TANF, you know, it's had several different incarnation names. But anyway, when you were there, when I was first on it, unbelievable, you had to have 3 references every month. You had to fill it out, and people were called to ask about if you were a good parent. You also had to report what birth control you were using every month. Now, Legal Services did a lawsuit, and that came off of there. And they had visits. The no man in the house rule, okay? That was real. I mean, and at that time, I wasn't really dating. I was like, I went through a period of like 2 or 3 years of just nothing, no relationship, because I was coming out, I think. And so Justin and I were just sort of in the world together, you know, and he was a wonderful, creative kid. So they would come over, yeah, and actually look around at your apartment. I mean, it's just, that stuff really happened. It's insane. So finally, but the reason I'm saying about being taken away is there were sodomy laws at that time. So I never told them I was a lesbian parent, but Justin's father was never in the picture until Justin was a lot older. But this always hung over my head that could be a way for him to get him away from me. And it could, because there were cases all across the country, several in Missouri at that time actually, where an abusive father got custody over a lesbian. I mean, there were like documented cases of it. So I'm like, okay, Justin's father's a recovering alcoholic and heroin addict. And that didn't even matter to me. I was like, well, that's not going to matter. But I think part of it was I knew it could happen, but Rick just didn't have the wherewithal to put all that together. And he has had enough personal issues that, and he lived out of state too, that it couldn't have happened. But it definitely, if I would have reported it, then the state itself could have acted on behalf of the child's best interests. Wow. And removed him and put him in state custody. So it was always sort of just looming there, you know? Mm-hmm. And when I'd say, I'd have to lie about birth control, you know? I mean, I gave references, and I'd have to tell the references, oh, remember not to say so-and-so when somebody calls you. And they were actually called. So, yeah.
Did being a single mother affect your student activism, things that you were doing on campus as well?
Actually, it encouraged it more because I felt like if I banded together with other people, and it really turned out to be true, that then we could share, you know, childcare, we could study together, the kids could play together, and there was this wonderful group. I don't think it's in existence anymore, but you know, you've heard of Raven. Okay. Raven used to have a group called Brothers in Change, and I don't think it's around anymore, but when I was younger lesbian, we used to have women's dances here all the time, and they would come to the lesbian dances and provide free childcare and give an opportunity for children to be around men who loved kids, and because Justin wasn't raised around men, he was really raised around mostly all lesbians, and then my mom. I mean, some of my other family members, but they didn't see him as much, even my brother, as women who were really connected to the community. So, no, I would think that's made me more insistent on not being isolated, was to try to join things and have things for myself and him that would then assist us while I was in school.
Was college kind of your entrance into the world of activism? What kind of like got you started in that?
Yes, and the first thing was the daycare center. Mm-hmm. So that really took a lot of just like organizing, knowing the workings of the college, how you write a proposal, and getting people interested, doing fundraising and grant writing. So that was the first thing. And then we did some workshops and stuff. There was this thing going on at the time called Fight the Right. Mm-hmm. And we did community information workshops, and I met some people. That's how I sort of, it became broader. There was an anti-violence project here. Susanna Rose, who's not here anymore, co-started it. And we became involved in that, and I met some other lesbians of color and women of color and other straight women allies that just wanted to work on anti-violence stuff. And she started a hotline, and then we'd have these forums where we would try, even back then, to get the police to, you know, stop harassing queer people. At the bars, they'd stand out and harass them. They'd follow them. They'd beat them up. I mean, we had a lot of that stuff going on. So that really politicized me, you know, just the whole issue of violence in our community. Then at Pride, you know, Pride, I mean, we'd be out there, but people would be followed and abused and harassed. So that kind of, like, made me think, like, this, there's so many other things going on in our community, let alone health issues and housing. Because at the time, too, I lived in Section 8. And my son was on the list for the first kind of group of magnet school kids. And after the desegregation and, was it a consent decree? I forget what it's called. Where the schools had to be integrated. Because, I mean, we're so racially segregated here. And so he was going to stay in the city and go to a school that was predominantly kids of color. You know, kids of color were then offered if they wanted to go to schools in white. You know what I mean? And so it was part of DSEG. So anyway, I got him on the list for that. And then I got on the list because it was the first time ever that South County was going to build a project-based Section 8. And I was threatened when I went to the meeting. Physically threatened, had to be walked out of the meeting because they said they do not want these folks living here. And I said, well, I'm one of those folks, so is that who you're talking about, or are you talking about black folks? And so they really weren't talking about me. So, but the way they said it was that I was speaking as a race traitor to them and that, you know, you better get yourself out of here and don't ever come back. And so that kind of led me also just to thinking about poor people and queer families that are poor and, you know, the state of housing and education for kids. And it just all started to kind of go together, and that's why I ended up being interested in social work.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
And we talked about also how your political ideology was kind of changing throughout college. Could you also speak on that? I know you talked about this was like your first interest into feminism and things like that.
Yeah, because the woman I told you, Margaret Erickson's her name, it's so weird to say her name after all these years, but who lost her life. But she just really got me thinking about a lot of stuff around kids, but also lesbian literature. I mean, it wasn't just kids. Her primary focus was on literature for children, but lots of stuff to read. So that caused me to really think about the broader reading of feminism and lesbian feminism, and I just started really taking extra, you know, reading materials home with me and starting kind of groups. We had informal kind of reading groups and stuff, lesbian reading groups. So that just kept broadening. It wasn't really until after I left Webster, I started working at a, well, I did a practicum there, so it was the end of my college year, at a battered women's shelter, and it was run by, first time ever, I've worked in a space completely run by black women. And I was the children's program coordinator. They wanted me to develop a program for babies through high school. I was like, okay. So, you know, but people would come in. It was just run by feminist women on the board. And, I mean, just, it was a collective and just such a wonderful experience. I mean, just a wonderful experience. I met some women that are still doing stuff today in different areas. But anyway, so that kind of broadened just in terms of violence against women, you know, patriarchy stuff, what really needs to be done, and children's issues still, again, all tied into that. But it just didn't seem enough. I mean, it felt like you were just sort of like, I'm in a shelter, you know, why can't the men leave? We used to say that. Leave the women, stay home, the men should be put in a shelter. So it just felt like, okay, I need to do something that gets to fundamental institutional change. And